So most of my trip was a journey through wilderness, a mix of public and private lands, including national parks in both Canada and in Alaska. And it occurred to me that these parks may not exist if it weren't for Emerson and his transcendentalist cadre. I found that there exists a lineage from Emerson through to John Muir, a writer and wilderness advocate, and on to Robert Marshall, a wilderness explorer and advocate I was introduced to on this trip. Each of these men were inspired by their direct experiences of the transcending mystery and wonder in nature, and they were motivated either to lobby Congress, start an organization, and all of them wrote from their deepest experiences in the earnest hopes of spreading their zeal for wilderness and its blessings. Our responsive reading, taken from Emerson's 1841 Divinity School address, The Oversoul, lifts up specific aspects of his beliefs. Emerson uses the term soul to refer to that which is transcended beyond us, that which goes beyond our individual and material perceptions, and connects us with something both universal and perhaps divine. The qualities of genius, virtue, and love emanate from this, he said. Emersonian scholar David Robinson said that by adding the prefix over to the idea of soul, Emerson found a way to retain the sense of a spirituality as both having an inward orientation, but also emphasize the idea that our innermost spiritual nature is something universal, not merely personal. Something universal, not merely personal. He wrote, "Within us is the soul of the whole, that wise silence, the universal beauty, to which every part and particle is equally related, the eternal one." I want you to notice the eyes if you can. I know it's hard, but they seem to have a light behind them. John Muir co-founded the Sierra Club and is known as the father of our national parks. On excursions into the backcountry of Yosemite, it is said that he traveled alone, carrying only a tin cup, a handful of tea, a loaf of bread, and a copy of Emerson. In 1871, after Muir had lived in Yosemite for 3 years, Emerson and Muir finally met. And according to one witness, Emerson was delighted to find at the end of his career the prophet naturalist he had called for so long ago. And as for Muir, Emerson's visit came like a laying on of hands to him. And I can't help but see this as a kind of John the Baptist meeting Jesus moment for Unitarian Universalism. Here are two passages from Muir's writings. "Walk away quietly in any direction and taste the freedom of the mountaineer. Camp out among the grasses and gentians of glacial meadows, in craggy garden nooks full of nature's darlings. Climb the mountains and get their good tidings. Nature's peace will flow into you as sunshine flows into trees, and the winds will blow their own freshness into you and the storms their energy, while cares will drop off like autumn leaves." And then, "No synonym for God is so perfect as beauty No synonym for God is so perfect as beauty. Whether as seen carving the lines of the mountains with glaciers, or gathering matter into stars, or planning the movements of water, or gardening, still all is beauty. All is beauty. Muir and Emerson seem to be cut from the same cloth. As Muir is the father of our national parks, Robert Marshall is the father of Gates of the Arctic National Park in Alaska and also founder of the Wilderness Society. He was driven by a passionate wanderlust, just the idea of an exploration for pure enjoyment, not scientific exploration, not conquest, but for the joy of it. At the age of 28, he was intrigued by two blank regions on the map of Alaska. Can you imagine looking at a map and seeing a blank space? He was drawn to the one that is now today part of the remote Brooks Range in the Gates of the Arctic National Park. And he devised a plan to study trees there and believed that he would be the first human to set foot in the region. He would later learn that while he was likely the first white man to explore that region, Alaska Natives had a long and deep history with that area, and that there were likely few places where no human had trod. Still, this didn't diminish his joy or wonder. If anything, it further shaped his activism, serving as director of forestry at the Forest Service and then working at the Office of Indian Affairs to save both wilderness and traditional native cultures. Marshall wrote that the only hope for the preservation of wilderness is the organization of spirited people who will fight for freedom of the wilderness, who will fight for the freedom of the wilderness. And he often spoke of his elation of days spent in the little explored, uninhabited world of the Arctic wilderness, and wrote several books about his experiences. Each of the portraits you've seen behind me, or in each of them, I can see the joy in their eyes, especially Muir and Marshall. Perhaps you can too. I can feel the delight, almost, of what they've seen. And that helps me connect to my own joy and delight over my recent travels through the wilderness. As we drove through Alberta and British Columbia, my mother-in-law and I marveled at the seemingly endless forests along rolling hills. And though we were driving through managed forests and saw frequent logging trucks, seeing day in and day out views of thick forests gave me hope that we hadn't yet destroyed all of the wilderness, that there was still so much green. We pulled off to the side of the road in northern British Columbia to watch this black bear eat grass. We turned off the engine, rolled down the window, and sat in silence, admiring it. I felt present then, enjoying the pace of the bear meandering, loping, head bobbing, chewing, almost as if I were eating grass along with the bear. During my trip, I didn't experience true darkness for a month. We had endless daylight, so that after pulling into a campground in British Columbia, I walked out to a nearby stream and was surprised to see beavers actively gathering their food and swimming around their lodge. Standing on that pebbled beach, I couldn't believe that I was getting a glimpse into their lives and habits, never having seen active beavers before. I don't know how common that is. And now here I was, less than 20 feet away from them, and I was abuzz with feeling. A Snowshoe hares were everywhere in Alaska, especially north of the Arctic Circle. And hares are part of an interesting web of existence with their predators, such as the fox, wolf, and lynx, and with their food sources, willows and other shrubs. When the hares are plentiful, so are their predators, but they also denude the willows and strip their bark. This causes those plants to release a toxin that makes the hares sick. And in turn, the hares find clay to lick, which is probably what they're doing out on the road here. And the clay contains an enzyme that counteracts the toxin for a while. Over time, the hare population will decline, as will that of their predators, and the plants will recover and prepare for another cycle. Seeing the hares and later feeling the surprise of a hare being chased by a lynx connected me to this ongoing cycle of life. The Trans-Alaska Pipeline runs alongside the Dalton Highway in Alaska, mostly elevated above the tundra, letting the animals migrate and travel underneath unimpeded. The pipeline and the oil fields up at Prudhoe Bay and even the road have been constructed in such a way so that it won't melt the permafrost under the tundra. This will protect critical habitat, such as the ponds that become nurseries for birds migrating in from all over the world. And I was surprised to learn that many Native Alaskans supported the pipeline's construction back in the day. It would provide needed revenue for schools, electricity, housing, as well as wilderness preservation. Even within the industrial area of Prudhoe Bay, animals went about their business, including a large herd of muskox south of town. And when the caribou decide to migrate through or a polar bear stumbles in for a nap, there are assigned protectors to document their movements, behavior, and ensure that safe distances are kept. When the oil eventually dries up, the pipeline and all related infrastructure will be removed. And it is envisioned that the U.S. will have a new hiking trail across Alaska. We took away some hope that coexistence between humans and nature was still possible. The muskox is one of the few mammals from the age of the woolly mammoth to still survive. In Alaska, they were hunted to extinction by the early 20th century, and they've since been reintroduced from other herds around the Arctic Circle. They are mesmerizing to watch as they walk, their long coats swaying. On his first exploration of the region, Marshall glimpsed two peaks that looked like gateways into an Arctic world, a monumental entrance to a land of mystery, he said. Naming them Frigid Crag on the left and Boreal Mountain, they became his altars, and watching the clouds clear off the summits seemed holier to him than a prayer, according to his brother. The chance to see these mountains or even get close to them was one of the main reasons I wanted to go on this trip. The idea of witnessing with my heart. Part of the largest pristine wilderness. As you can tell, it fills me with emotion. And finally, in seeing these parks, these peaks, and these gates, I felt a sense of adventure, pulling me toward the headwaters of that river, wanting to experience it for myself. On our road trip in our red SUV, we were companions, kindred pilgrim souls on a voyage to an uncharted world under the endless light of the summer sun. Just as today, we who are gathered here journey together on our blue boat home.